questions. This might get too loud for you guys. I talk kind of loud. I send out questions, and then, you know, I'm thinking about it regularly, you know, from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and, you know, I'm like, oh, I should change that, I should add that, but, you know, it is what it is. This morning, we're going to explore the stories of Hannah and Samuel and talk about maybe some the positive traits that they exemplified and possibly some pitfalls, and I hope to explore that with you guys. If we don't get stormed out. But we start at the opening of 1 Samuel, and we have Elkanah, who is a man who has two wives, and there is some bickering between those wives, Hannah and then, and apologize, I'm not good with ancient Hebrew names, and the other wife. I don't have it readily available. And the passage says that, you know, she was her rival, Hannah's rival. And Hannah couldn't have children, and she very much desired to have children. And Elkanah, you know, he tries to console her and says, you know, aren't I enough than children, you know? And all that leads me to believe is that two wives sounds like a lot of work. But one thing I wanted to explore, you know, and maybe this, you know, how I phrase this question right out the gate, I wasn't exactly happy with it, but it is what it is. But how do we feel about Hannah's desire to have a child? And, you know, specifically, do we feel that the desire to have a child is an inherently godly desire? And to sort of give you context on where my head is at, I have noticed between people in my peer group that there is an aversion to having children. And there is a almost children are a problem and are costly and, you know, I would rather do without them. And so I would be interested in thoughts on how we, you know, sort of perceive her desire to have a child, because I don't think it's unique to Hannah. We see it also with other women in the Old Testament. Yeah, and that's my takeaway, is that it wasn't just Hannah's desire to have a child. It was the idea that I'm going to have a child, and that child will serve the Lord. And that is why I want to have a child, not only so that I can influence those in my sphere, in my family, but that I can influence people towards Christianity down the road, which I think is a powerful you know, thing there. In 1 Samuel 2, verses, you know, 1 through 10, we see sort of after she has a child and after she's weaned Samuel, we see Hannah's prayer. And in verse 1 there, it says, "And Hannah prayed and said, 'My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation.'" I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. Do we have this level of confidence in the power of God's salvation? This sort of struck out to me in this prayer that, you know, is very much a prayer towards God's power and defeat of his enemy and him being a rock of salvation. But this sort of stuck out at me as a very vivid confidence that she seems to have. Yes. Anyone else? Yes.
My recollection of the record is perhaps a vote in against my position. Both times I speak of the showing in prayer to act with the veteran salvation was an active thing, not something that's passive. We have showed that her action.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it struck out to me because it's a vivid picture that I can relate with of being closed in on all sides, but internally being at peace and being able to smile and say, God is with me. So I, you know, appreciate those thoughts. I found in 1 Samuel 2, after Hannah brings Samuel to Eli, after she's weaned him and brings him to live with Eli, there's no question here, it's just me talking. There's almost a like sweet few verses there in 18 through 21. That I can just imagine, like Hannah going to bring the ephod to Samuel. But it just really exemplified to me that it wasn't just like wanting a child at the beginning. It was, you know, she actually cared for this child. I don't know how many of us would make the decision to have our kid live in the classroom and help Jason with his lessons. But, you know, kind of seems like a similar thing there. What examples, you know, looking at Hannah and her example, I mean, what examples does Hannah set for our mindset in parenting? And in the questions, if you have them in front of you, I don't have a printer right now, so I'm using my computer, kind of cheating. I ask you all to consider Psalms 127:4, Proverbs 22:6, and Joshua 24:15. And I can read those. In 127:4, it's, you know, like arrows in the hands of a warrior are children born in one's youth. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way that he should go, even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And then Joshua 24:15, of course, is, you know, Joshua's sort of declaration, but if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you'll serve, whether the gods of your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. So how does Hannah's, you know, how does Hannah sort of exemplify the mindset of parenting? And to give you sort of a preview, if we have time, I think this theme kind of runs through some of the first 16 chapters of 1 Samuel in the parenting context. Yes.
Look at her whole purpose of going with the child and everything and what she's doing with it. And I think that, to me, is the thing that stands out. It's like we want children, but we're training them and to be of service to the Lord. that's what she was doing with Vivian. She had a child to give back to the Lord in service to him. That was her focus. The Lord blesses her with more children, but it causes her devotion and everything there. We have no record of exactly what happened with those kids or anything, but you would like to think that they have that kind of sample of devotion.
Anyone else?
Oh.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
I was kind of thinking along the same lines as Aaron, but she understood the day when the child came from. And I think in our modern world, we forget sometimes that God gives us our children.
Yeah.
That they're gifts from Him. But also, I always think about this, and I think that we're so worried about our children's society that someone's going to hurt their psyche or their, you know, that we're. Samuel seems to have understood exactly what his mother did and that she loved him. Isaac wasn't destroyed for life by what happened to him. When parents are serving the Lord and you know it,
yes,
it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, so. I appreciate that. You know, to me, Hannah's desire to have Samuel, her love for Samuel was one of extreme focused dedication to God. I think for me, as a young father with young kids, it comes down to, you know, the lesson I take is that raising kids should be done with, you know, deliberately and with purpose. Looking around, it seems like threats to our children, you know, becomes more pervasive with, you know, the evolution of technology. But then in the culture, it seems more and more so that children have become an accessory at the same time. And so fighting back against that is something, you know, that I have tried to internalize. I want to take a short detour to somebody who is not who's neither Samuel nor Hannah, because I think it relates here, and that's Eli. Contrast the sons of Eli, the judge of the time of Israel. The Bible says that they were absolutely corrupt individuals. You know, how does this happen?
Children for him, and
Yeah, thanks for that. I think another issue here with Eli is he tries to, in verses 22 through 25 of chapter 2, you have sort of this interaction between Eli and his sons where he tries to, you know, scold them in his old age. I think it becomes harder to guide your child as your child gets older. I mean, it's almost, you know, going back to the passage about, you know, children being, you know, the arrows in the quiver. You know, once you let it loose, right, it's hard to correct the path of that arrow. And so, you know, it reminds me of David when he was on his deathbed with Solomon. And I almost made this comment in that class. You know, it's like when you're on your deathbed is not the time to give all of the lessons to your kids, you know. That should be happening much, much earlier. So I think just the observation of Eli, because I think it's a good contrast to things that happen later, as well as, you know, Hannah, you know, the discussion we had about Hannah. Any other comments on Eli? Yes.
This is maybe going out of
Yeah.
And then there's no reason Eli himself was a little bit better. It was like you've been, you know, that 29, 10th grade. Anyway, I don't know. Obviously, he wasn't doing any of the sexual immorality, but, and we don't see any indication that he was, like, you know, ripping off the sacrifice when it came, but, you know, possibly he also was, like, overindulgent.
Yeah. Yes. Points, although I did not have the same take. I appreciate that, Josh. I'll have to think more on that. Turning to Samuel, Samuel's a boy. He's with Eli, and you know, in 1 Samuel 3, the Lord calls Samuel. Is there anything that you find interesting about, you know, the appearance to Samuel in this episode? And this isn't, you know, I'm not looking for a specific answer. It just seems like an interesting event. I've always thought so. Yes.
Well, it's interesting the role Samuel ends up in. We see him later offering sacrifices, and which Saul wasn't authorized to do. If you go by tribe, neither was Samuel. But I don't know if he was as the firstborn that opened the womb. If that was there was no Levite given to redeem him, or, you know, if that just became his role, or how that worked. But it certainly he was recognized, as in the later chapter, he was recognized as a prophet.
Yeah.
Which was uncommon in those times. So, yeah, I think it's just interesting the role he falls into.
One quick thing here. It's not even in this part, but if you go to another passage, it's Samuel. It does appear that Samuel, the father, was from probably by him. I think the thing that strikes me, one of the things, and like I say, it's just kind of a unique thing here. He hears his voice, he thinks Eli's talking to him. The thing that always kind of got me was Eli's the one who figures out what's going on and tells him, hey, the worst right to listen.
Yeah.
And then, next thing when he's talking to him, he's like, okay, what did he tell you? And the Samuel credit, he tells him. And I don't know if you want to say he likes credit or anything, but thank you for the sense that he whatever the board says, he's a good thing. But just still a very young man at this time. The Lord recognizes who he is. He calls him there. He's laying out all these very detailed things about what he's going to do to be like his son and everything. That's just a lot to lay on kids. That can't be what comes.
Yeah. No, I agree. I found interesting, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, just sort of the personification, it feels like, of the word of the Lord, you know, in a few of the verses there. Because verse 1 says, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. And then verse 10, it's talking about the Lord, but it says the Lord came and stood, which is just interesting seeing, you know, and maybe that's figurative, but, it's interesting. And then in 21, the Lord appeared again in Shiloh. And then just the seeming distance of the voice of the Lord to where Samuel believed that, Eli was calling him from another room. I found that interesting. I wanted to think about the verse in Samuel 2:26. And the child Samuel grew in stature and in favor both with the Lord and men. Where do we find an identical or an almost identical description?
It's about
Jesus. Yep. Yeah. And are there any similarities in the context of where Jesus was at the time? I'm not pointing at you to answer. In the context of where Jesus was at the time, in the context of where Samuel is right now. Yeah. Yeah. And that verse has always stuck out to me because it's grew in stature, and whether you're talking about Jesus or Samuel, and in favor with both the Lord and men, or both God and men. Why in men? Like, what is favor with men? Why is that important? What does that mean in this context? Yeah.
So, I think what it shows is consistency in everything. You have somebody who is truly, the reputation they have may have in these four walls, so to speak, the same reputation they had outside.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on that? Yeah, I appreciate that connection because I didn't think about it that way either.
But he'll be that last judge.
Yeah.
That brings the kingdom back up.
I appreciate that. No, I mean I agree. I think it's important for us not to try to earn the favor of men through doing worldly deeds and being like them. But I think there are universal virtues and traits that are respected by the world that are important that we don't often think about. You know, I think about Paul at the Areopagus and his ability to have rhetoric and reason to which these people respected. I think about competence and hard work and diligence that people look at and they're like, I want to be more like that person. You know, enthusiasm about what you do. These are things that, you know, maybe not on their surface are you know, sort of the seem like core biblical, like, traits. I think they're important, though, and I think they are. In the intervening time here, we have an episode about the Ark of God being taken by the Philistines. I'm not going to get too much into it, but it's you know, a series of events that's sort of like the Philistine cities playing hot potato with the Ark, because they keep getting a plague at each city the Ark goes to. And so, you know, the Ark comes back, eventually comes back. But then we have, you know, after the Ark comes back in 1 Samuel 7, you know, we have a command from Samuel to the Israelites, because the Israelites had not been living, you know, as is often the case, had not been living in true devotion and faith to the Lord. What was Samuel's command to the Israelites? And more importantly, I guess, what does it say about the nature of repentance? Wanted a clean house? How so? Yeah. And, I mean, how do we connect this to, you know, repentance in our own lives? Yeah, I think there has to be a complete turning away from the things that are causing you sin. And I look to sort of, you know, Matthew 5:29 on some of this, but there are so many things that are impediments that can become impediments in our life that I think it's important to be able to do some self-reflection. And if you are truly repenting, you're identifying those things and you're doing away with those things. Any other comments on Samuel's command to clean house? So we get down a little further, and funny enough, in 1 Samuel 8, we see that Samuel has a problem with his own family. So how could this happen? I mean, he sort of received the prophecy, or I mean, he was there when the prophecy occurred that, you know, Eli's family would be cut off and he would be punished, you know. But then you sort of have a similar situation with Samuel. And, you know, oh, sorry, what? Yeah.
So either he wasn't aware of what was happening with time. Tim put them in those positions for a while, but they're put in these positions and not removed when it's evident that they're corrupt. And that's the part that really strikes me, both.
Yeah. And I just, I found this interesting, starting with Hannah, you know, and kind of seeing that, that dedication as a parent, that focused dedication, and then running through Eli and then running through Samuel. It is just, it's, you know, it, it's interesting to me. But when Israel, oh, sorry.
That's okay. You can go ahead and finish your phone.
Oh, no, I was moving on, so please.
Oh, okay. Well, I think it reminds me a little bit of Being a Preacher's Kid, but they had grown up with a little bit of a special position with him, I guess.
Yeah.
And their fathers were also busy with a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see how this could happen, that you're a little bit special and people treat you that way.
Yeah.
And so you start thinking,
I've asked myself that when I raised my son. Like, I'm not special, but you know, do I treat them special, or do I, you know, like knock them down a peg and make them stay humble? Like, you know, balancing that out. So I definitely can see that.
Like Sam was saying earlier, do I talk to my children the way I talk to other people's children about things?
Yeah. Yeah,
I
agree.
Yes.
Yeah. They should know.
They should know.
Yeah. So this sort of becomes a problem because, well, when Israel initially demands a king, what is their initial justification? Yeah. Does this episode or recounting, you know, serve as a lesson for how our lives can not only lead people to God, or, you know, our families, or our, you know, however you want to put it, but also away from God? Yes. I think, you know, I added this, but consider also that the reason that they provided initially may have been pretextual, and that they really just wanted a king so that they could be like everyone else, right? But does that change? Does that change? Does that change it? Does that change the lesson there? I mean, the reason I feel... Yes. Because everyone is looking for a reason why your faith is actually fake, and why you going to church, it's not worth it. Worshiping God, you know, it's not worth it because you did this. Your kids did this. I actually saw you one time do this. When a lot of times, they don't want to do it anyway. And so when you give them that excuse by your public, you know, making mistakes in public or, you know, sinning or just all around having a reputation that reflects badly, you give them that excuse. And that's what I see from this story, is that the people come and they say, well, you know, your kids, they're pretty messed up. But, you know, also we want a king anyway so he can lead us into battle, right? No, you just... My interpretation, and I may be wrong, this is just me speaking, it seems like you just wanted a king, and you found a reason. And so that sticks out to me. That seems that is important to me because I think it... I want to lead a life that, you know, where you can't point to something and say, hey, look at this person, look at what they did. That's why I'm not going to become a Christian. However insincere that may be. Any other comments on that? Yes.
It is sobering to read an account like this and personally stand with my own view of God. It seems like a very violent person, and yet his kids turned out to be the way. And he's not the only example of this. He's that David one. He's that King Hezekiah, his son and Asa, which is about the worst king ever.
Yeah. So Samuel addresses the people later in Samuel 12 after Saul engages in a few skirmishes, and I'll skip past some of that. And I just want to get, you know, in that address to the people, he leads off with sort of a challenge to the people. And I think this is related to the last point. But he leads off with a challenge to the people to make accusation against him. Is there a lesson here? Do you take anything from that? Thoughts? Anything whatsoever? Because immediately after that, he launches into, hey, you guys wanted a king and you sinned. You know, after he says, hey, have I sinned against you? Have I, like, taken any of your stuff? And they say no. And he's like, God's witness that you said no. And they're like, God is witness. And he says, okay, let me tell you your mistake here. I just, you know, interested in thoughts on that. Yeah.
He's just laying out for them in no uncertain terms what I've done wrong. And they don't have a charge to put against them. So he's like, okay, he's taking that away from them so that they can see their sin. At the end of this, they do see that. And they ask him to help in their later. So I think that's what the end goal is.
Yeah, I mean, he essentially allows them to take their shot, you know, first at him. And I think the power of your reputation bolsters your message to other people. That's the takeaway I get from it. When you're speaking with non-Christians, the power of your reputation bolsters your message. And I mean, it can aid in piercing, you know, the hearts of yeah.
And also, like at the very beginning of the chapter, when he says that Samuel's sons were not like Samuel, they were not like his father. Which is a pretty big juxtaposition to the way he treats Eli. And he actually goes to, like, tell Eli his sons are going to do it, they're going to die. You know?
Yeah.
So I really feel like there's never another mention about it. I mean, it's just there's this one line, like, Samuel's sons were not like he was. You know, the people were complaining about it.
Yeah, good comment. Don't have a lot of time here, but skipping over to Saul's disobedience to God with the Amalekites, it's just interesting because he starts off with, I did what God said, right? I did exactly what God said. I just left the king alive, and then my guys took some cattle. And then he says, oh, well, actually, I didn't. I listened to my men because I feared them. And it's interesting because looking at the text, Saul seems like a courageous guy. He seemed like a courageous guy in battle. But when it came to sort of standing up to his own men, there seemed to be a bit of lack of courage there. And then the interaction ends with Samuel, departing from Saul for good. And I sort of asked, is there ever a time to leave someone alone with their sin? Yeah. This one's tough. Yeah.
So yes, I think you have to turn it over to God, and that might mean you're out of it.
No, I agree. I've seen people go round and round in circles with people they absolutely love, but who are in a deep pit of, appreciate it. Yes.
We waste so much time on a person that maybe is not interested, and we know this, and we miss other opportunities because we're so focused on that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but
it. Yes. I'm thinking of situations in my own life and my family members' life. A part of this lesson has to do with that, and I know there's people who, really lose sleep over someone they really care about that they are working on constantly, and the heart is very hardened and they are not willing to, they don't want to obey, right? They genuinely want to stand in opposition to God. And that's something that's hard to deal with if you are someone who is a family member of that person.
And you're wasting your time.
Yes.
Not
yes, I agree with that as well. Yes.
Are we talking about the same concept as catching from the horse line or brushing the dust on your feet kind of thing?
I think so. Yes. Sorry, was there? Okay. Yeah.
Or when someone has decided that they will turn away. I mean, I finally had a discussion with one of my children has fallen away. I prayed that she would come back, but she finally said, we're done talking. I'm done talking about this. You know what I think? If I change my mind, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
And she is much more open now, after a few years, to discuss it again without arguing. Because she knows I'm not honest with her anymore.
Tough situations.
But we waste our time.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yes.
I think D.D. was making a really good point there about the fact that sinners sometimes really want to have good people in their lives next to them so they can feel good. And Saul definitely did that. Saul was like, oh, Samuel, come.
come back to me. You know, I just went, Jay, look, if you come stand next to me again, Jay, look, if you bless me, like, he thought that by having a man of God near him, physically even, that somehow he just didn't feel okay, like he was okay with God. And you know, he able just had to remove himself. And I think that's kind of the point in 1 Corinthians. Because you can't let sin come into the presence of the Lord and sort of claim that sort of godly aura from being around the Christian community and being a part of it, hanging around. That's why we have those verses that say, you know, you have to remove that person from you. Both because you don't want to be associated with that kind of thing, so where the world looks and says, like, what is this? You guys have several verses on your lips. You guys are not very holy. You know, that kind of thing. But then also, to the person themselves, will, you know, recognize they don't have that holiness in their life. They can't use that as a crutch or as like a sort of a pseudonym for holiness and have a holy man right next to
this. Was that kind of what you were, was that... Yeah, no, because I do think when you're doing this, you know, I think Christians can become an impediment to sinners because they think, oh, I'm absorbing, you know, you're a good person and I'm next to you, right? And it doesn't really allow them to come to terms with their sin. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate the thoughtful discussion.